My name is Peter Nash. I teach Hebrew Bible and Hebrew at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Evanston, Illinois. And this is the second of five sessions this week in Bible study on the story of Joseph, and asking the question, as much of myself in the text as of you, is a theology presented in the Joseph story a theology of defeat or a theology of victory? And I hope we get at that question beginning today, actually. Where exactly did we leave off yesterday? We did actually begin the Joseph story. Somewhat we kind of raced through it. We'll go back to the beginning today. But before we do that, let me say that two things are going to happen. At least two things are going to happen. I would like at least two things to happen. One is for you to understand what kind of approach I take to the text. I mentioned at the very end yesterday that what I do, some people call subversive, and call it that. Some call it subversive intentionally and are proud of it, and some call it subversive as a derogatory comment. It is somewhat subversive in that we try to get under the text and twist it around, not to distort it, but to understand what it meant to the people who heard it the first time and the second time, thousands of years ago, understanding that they lived in a very different world from the world in which we live. And the analogy that works best for me is, since I am first by education a translator of text, is that there are two major schools or two ends of the spectrum when it comes to translation. One is called a dynamic translation. Well, let me start with the one that you're probably more familiar with or aware of, or were forced to do as you learned your first or second other language. And that is a literal translation, one in which you strive for one-to-one or phrase-to-phrase correspondence from source language to target language. So when you pick up the Hebrew Bible or the Greek New Testament or Plato or Aristotle or Luther, whomever, whatever you pick up, if Luther uses the word for father, the common word for father, then you use the common word for father in the English translation. If he uses an odd word for father, then you try to find the odd word for father that matches the characteristics there. But you strive for one-to-one. What's here in the text is what we present without a whole lot of emphasis on the entire cultural background of the word, of the language. So some words get laden with much, much more than can be conveyed by one word. The strict translation is not always able, in its striving for linguistic purity, to give you all of that background. They say, go talk to the historians and then you will understand. The other end of the spectrum is what's called the dynamic translation, where people are much freer in the translation. Sometimes it's called free translation. The point here is to get the impact of the word rather than a one-to-one correspondence. So those who look for a dynamic translation are also very concerned with staying as true to the text as possible, but they try to find a cultural situation that is similar within the translation so that it has the same effect on you when you hear the words as those who first heard it. And let me see if I can think of an example. Some cultural institutions have simply gone by the boards for the most part in the industrialized West. I do not expect my older brother, the firstborn son, to inherit any more of what little there is of my parents' estate. then I will. The four of us, firstborn son, secondborn son, thirdborn son, and fourthborn daughter, all expect to share equally or according to our needs. There are some words in Hebrew and in Greek that, and in English, which most of us don't know, that indicate that that just simply when you use that word, it just tells you that this is the firstborn, and that he, firstborn son, and that he is in line to inherit more. Now, if we were to translate those words word for word into 20th century English, we'd read right past them and miss the impact of the story. Is that clear? What I'm trying to say? So what a dynamic translation tries to do is to pull the impact of that culture to our culture, so it hits us the same way, so it's immediately clear to us that this is a person that's going to, that expects more in the culture than any of the other brothers do, or any of the other children do, when it comes time for dad and mom to go into the next world. That's by way of analogy. We try to, in translation, one way or the other, be very, very true to the text itself, and the text is what is important. Getting the text from one language to another, and the second is trying to be very true to the emotional and intellectual impact of the story that is contained within the text. The same thing happens in interpretation and in preaching. You'll hear preachers who, and this varies upon your intellectual capacities and what makes you comfortable, what you grew up with. Some preachers simply exposit the text as it was, and then make the step to what it means today, and by another means. Other preachers will get up and they will tell you a wonderful story about that gets across the same point as Paul's letter, the second chapter of Paul's letter to the Philippians. And some of us, when we hear those sermons, I'm one of them, as a matter of fact, walk out and say, what has that got to do with Paul? Because I, most of the time, am not a very allegorical or analogical thinker. And I'm working at it. And so that's the point today, is I'm going to force some of this on you in my attempts to be better at that. So you're going to hear some analogies that I think have the same emotional, similar sociological situations and some of the same impact that the Joseph story had back when it was first heard, whether it was in the 6th or 7th century, when some of us think that it was first actually written down for the people of Israel returning from exile, or whether the story was first told during the period of the exile, Exodus, which it set up as the story moves along. Any questions or comments about that?
Jeff? In German, we have two words for history. One is historie, the other is geschichte. The historie will deal with the Battle of Newport exactly in the year 1600. The geschichte interpretation of history is telling you why it happened. What was the impact? What were the circumstances? And it's not concerned that it was 1600 or 1601.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're talking about.
That's part of what I'm talking about. And in addition to that, what I'm trying to get at is the emotional load of how people responded to it in the situation.
Yeah.
But that's very much a part of it. Those are very much parts of it. Yes.
Could we use the prodigal son to the impact of the first son, you say, might be missed by our modern society?
Absolutely. That he had so much coming to him we very clearly hear he stayed home. He didn't ask for his inheritance before his dad died. I mean, that's pretty offensive to us still. Staying home and being concerned about family and home and parents is a sacrifice that still makes sense to us. But what we don't hear in that story of the prodigal son, or the forgiving father, whichever you choose to call it, is that he was entitled to a bigger portion, so that, you know, really what the second son asked for was not as great as we might think in our culture, because he got at best what was left of half. First son typically got half and was the head of the household that was left by the father. The other children split then what was left. And we don't hear that when we hear the story. Most of us don't hear that when we hear the story these days. So with that in mind, we'll move on into Joseph. We talked a little bit about the gifts that he had. Yes, ma'am. Oh, are you doing yarn or something like that? All right, from now on, if you're doing needlework and you sit in the front row so I can see when your hand goes up. I tried to establish yesterday that Joseph had a couple of gifts, all of which seemed to cause him trouble. The gift from his father, which only increased his brother's hatred for him more, as the story tells us. I think it's in 37:8. The dream increased their hatred for him. The quote comes up in 3. And in 4, we see that the brothers, you know, immediately were tipped off to that. He's not the firstborn. Dad does seem to like Rachel better, and he's her first son. Are we going to be aced out of the deal here? Remember that one of the things that could happen in the ancient Near East, we do not get an indication that it's happening here, but we know the end of the story, is that sons of other wives could be left out of the inheritance altogether. Leah's sons should be secure. That's the first wife, and she holds a preeminent position within the family. Rachel's sons seem to be pretty well set because she's the favorite wife. But the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, Rachel's handmaid and Leah's handmaid, they're at jeopardy, as we saw in the story of Ishmael. So when they see, all of these older sons see Joseph getting this special treatment, at least a little more than half of them have real reason for concern that they're just going to be left on their own. They're only half brothers. And that is when we point that out, that's something that we can hear today with so many blended families, as there, I think, is a term that's being used, as divorce and remarriage becomes much, much more common than anybody teaches us about in elementary school or taught me about in elementary school. Families look a lot different, and half-brothers and half-sisters are very concerned about who gets more affection, who's going to inherit what, and especially when couples remarry after the children are out of the house. I've heard some absolutely unbelievable, unchristian stories about what happens when the wills get read, or when, just at the marriage, what's going to happen to your resources, Dad, as opposed to her resources, Dad, or your resources, Mom, as opposed to his resources, Mom. It's, again, a very real problem for us that maybe the Joseph story tells us we need to think about. It doesn't give us any answers, but points up that their life, although it was incredibly different in some ways, wasn't emotionally that different from ours. And that's another thing that I like to use biblical stories for, is to give us some permission to see that human beings haven't changed much. The personal concerns that we have, for the most part, are the same personal concerns that they had 4,000 years ago. Technology certainly has changed things, but human beings have not changed that much. Yes?
That happens daily. I'm a real estate closer. I have a closing company. And when you buy real estate, the last thing you do is get the title changed. And it used to be that 99.9% of the time, if it was a husband and wife, they would take title as what we call joint tenants, that automatically, if my husband died, I would get everything. Well, now it's, you have to ask every time, do you want it this way, or tenants in common, that if something happened to him, his half would go to the children and not automatically to me. And, you know, this birthright stuff, I mean, it's there all the time, probably even more now than even 4 years ago.
And one of the things that's happening is that women are not being excluded from the work that they put into the property in the way that they were automatically 4 years ago, 15 years ago. And I think some of that we need to be thankful for. I mean, it's messier, but it was only neat because some people were being excluded. Half of the population
was being excluded. I don't know if it's true out here, but there's something called a spousal interest that before divorce was acceptable in the Plains, a guy decided he didn't want married life anymore. He'd go into town and sell his property to the local banker or whatever, and his wife and children would find out that he had done this because they'd say, I own the house, get out. Now in Minnesota, you cannot sell I can buy all the property I want without my husband's name on the title, and he's the same, but to sell it, you need to have each other's signature, so that's on there, but still it's this, one of the biggest hassles we've got is who owns the property and where's it going.
Mm. Yeah. So the guy in Minnesota would show up with the mustache and say, pay the rent.
Not anymore.
Well, I haven't gotten us through these gifts yet, have I? We've got the gift of the code and we've got the gift of dreams. The gift of dreams, is, as the story is told, is unique to Joseph. He has, there is some indication in his psyche, and apparently in the psyche of his brothers, that says this guy's destined for something, and if he's destined for something, that means we're destined for something lower. Part of that is the gift that his father's given indicates that they're already out of balance as far as their culture is concerned. Last week we spent the whole week talking about shalom and how it is a balance between within a community and with the community and its surroundings, not only those who live around, but the very environment itself. Well, here, already within this very small concentric circle, they're out of balance. And I think we get some indications here that the balance is damaged so much that it's not going to be able to be fixed without divine intervention. The brothers in 4 cannot speak on friendly terms or speak civilly. We mentioned this yesterday, didn't we? Cannot speak to him in shalom. And then later in this chapter, when he goes out to look for his brothers, his directions are to go seek, inquire about the shalom of your brothers and of the flock. Well, at least we got the order right. But it's sort of a wild goose chase. Because it doesn't exist within the family, he can't find them. And he wanders around, and some stranger finds him wandering and says, what are you looking for? And he does his best to set him on the right track. But the brother's response when they see him is quite interesting. Someone pointed out in the first Bible, in the staff Bible study, that she came from a big family and that every family has a twit. And I thought that was appropriate. Several authors looking at Joseph, I think Thomas Mann, I think is where we're supposed to say it once we're educated. Indicated that Joseph was sort of a sniveling brat. he looked at his study of the Joseph story, or his exposition of the Joseph story. And he really does, in verse 2, He's a tattletale. He does everything in his part to sort of increase his weight. And he's not a little boy. He's 17. And he's virtually an adult. He's an adult in this culture. So it's sort of the plant stoolie, if you will. Yes, Leona.
I have a question. Before you said what you did about Joseph as a tattletale and the word twin, I was thinking almost the opposite, and because I'm thinking of Joseph, the adult later, and I'm thinking of words like forgiving and loving, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if that characteristic might have been developed even as a child, coming along, and perhaps maybe because he might have been sort of goody-two-shoes to his brothers, that he might have always been in his father's favor because he was Rachel's child, and father loved Rachel more, but also maybe because he was always in his father's good graces and obedient to him, and that maybe they saw him that way.
Yeah, and certainly in some parts of the culture, that's another way to be a twit, is just to be
good.
Part of, yeah, be good and be part of the establishment, which is certainly what Joseph is. The picture that I get of Jacob as I read through his story, unless you take 32 to be an absolute conversion experience for Jacob, is he's not the kind of guy who's going to take in the goody two shoes. That's not naturally going to be his favorite. He's pretty much the trickster. There's a lot of deception going on as he moves toward his prosperity. So it's possible. But it's so far it's not the way that I read the story.
So would Joseph have also undergone a conversion that gave him this ability to forgive his brothers as he did?
I think you have to say yes that he did undergo some sort of conversion and maturation. Mm-hmm. There's also a deep longing. We're jumping ahead a little bit, a couple of days, but there's a deep longing. I mean, he's away from his people for years and years, and there he's confronted with his brothers. And his first response is not compassion for anyone other than his father and his full brother. He wants to make sure that Benjamin hasn't been offed in the same way that his brothers tried to eliminate him, and wonders if his father, who loved him so dearly, who's still mourning him, apparently 20 years later, is still alive. But he really runs.
And he ran him around a little bit first, didn't he?
Yeah, he runs the brothers really through the ringer.
Right.
And the climax of the story, it really is, he breaks down. I mean, that seems to be where the conversion comes for Joseph. And we get to what I think is a theological high point. God sent me ahead to preserve life. And that he comes to that realization that he can stop abusing his power. I did mention yesterday that when Joseph changes clothes, there's a change, and people in general change clothes, but especially with Joseph, when he changes clothes, there's a change in status. And did we look at the first place that happens? Did we get him actually into the pit yesterday? No. Okay, let's then jump down to verse 18, 37 verse 18. When Joseph's wild goose chase, as I see it, finally does end, and he gets within sight of his brothers, if you have any question that this relationship is really out of whack, just look at the brother's response. It's not, oh, let's hide, I don't want to deal with him, or you take care of him, or let's send him someplace else. When they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. Now, I have a brother that three of us regard, the other three of us regard as sort of a twit. But none of us has ever suggested that we kill him. I hope he never hears this tape.
The other two will always think that you're talking about them.
Well, one's a sister, so she knows. She's out of the picture. And well, I won't say any more lest I incriminate myself. And listen now as we move through this to the arguments and what there is of a response that gets Joseph out of this death sentence from his loving brothers. I guess when you want to sell something, you always sell the people's own self-interest. But there's very little about, no, it's wrong to kill your brother. There's a little bit of that, but it doesn't get responded to. This next session is a little bit confusing because most of us think that there are two stories side by side that serve two different purposes, and they're blended together to sort of, it's a literary compromise. Again, the whole of Genesis is woven together, and this is one of the few places in Joseph where you see this kind of weaving happening. Otherwise, Joseph seems pretty much a one-author, one-shot deal, taking a tradition and weaving it into a sort of an up, you know, to the climax and down and out story. And they said to one another, "Here comes the dreamer. Now let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. We will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of the hands of his brothers and said, "Let us not take his life." Someone else pick up, because I'm reading from a different translation, which is pretty wooden compared to yours.
"And Reuben said unto them," do you mind this translation?
Is that the RSV there?
No.
Is it King James?
James.
Yeah, someone with the RSV, I think that's what most of us are reading, and then those of us who don't have the RSV can make it.
"Let us not take his life," Reuben said to them, "shed no blood, throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore.
Okay, let me just stop right there. Talk about a change in status and a change of clothes. They stripped him and go from being the brother who's pretty much the equal down, literally down into the pit. So thank you. Go ahead, please.
"And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. There Judah said to his brothers,"
Now let me stop you right there, okay? So we've got Reuben as the rescuer story, and we've got Ishmaelites coming down on their way to Egypt. Now, Ishmaelites becomes sort of a generic term for caravan traders, so it may be that they were actually Midianites, which we'll hear about in the next story, and that we may actually just have one story, as some have suggested, that just they're not very careful with the language as they use it. But isn't this a great story? You see your brother come, or your sister if you only have sisters, and let's kill her. And the whole family agrees, except for one. And they say, "Well, okay, we'll throw her into the pit." You yank the coat, and the prized possession, the gift from your father or mother, with the plan of staining it with blood to deceive your parent. Throw the sibling into the pit, and what do? You sit down and eat. You know? What cold-blooded brothers we have here. Well, I don't think it's an accident. I think it's meant, you know, where else do we eat in the ancient Near East? Certainly around the family table. Any other meals that you can think of?
Funerals.
Funerals, yes.
Celebrations.
Covenant making.
That's right.
You make a covenant, you make a deal, and you sit down to eat with the god or with the king or with your equal in the contract. Co-contractor or whatever, whatever word there is in English for that. Maybe accidental, but from what the way I read the text, the biblical writers didn't do much of this by accident. They may not have done it for the reason I think it's there, but the meal is not an accident. Even if it's simply the family meal, well, where is the time when the family is supposed to be at peace? When you're supposed to exhibit the fullness of the family and the plentitude or the dearth that you have. It's around the table, you share what you have. These guys throw one. Comments about this this first rescue? Reuben, I think this is, I said this is the first story. Reuben is the firstborn. He has the responsibility to preserve the rest of the family. He's the parentis in loco. Use a term that universities and colleges used to use before 18 was the age of majority. I guess we're going back to that that term at Boston University and others. He's the one who's responsible for all of his younger brothers. And so he needs to be redeemed in this story. And it is he is the logical one to step in and say, I've got some responsibility here. I don't like him either, but I can't let this happen.
He seemed to me to be more of a diplomat in the family, like, well, I don't like him around either. I agree he's kind of a twit, but let's not kill him anymore.
Yeah. He's also the one that, according to the plan, is going to inherit half of the family family goods and be the head of the household, so he's got less to lose than his younger brothers. Let's go ahead and see about Judah and how he steps in.
Yeah, a question from the upper belt.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I wonder if when they decided to sell him off, I wonder if Reuben got a piece of the action.
Well, that comes up more in the I think in the Judah version of it. Let's go ahead with 26.
Okay.
Because there's an actual mention of profit here.
Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some Mennonite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt.
Okay. Account for inflation, and there's 30 pieces of silver from the New Testament. Actually heard a very funny and very good Acadian lecture about 30 pieces of silver, and it went the world that way. But at any rate, this is how we get Joseph down there. Anybody have any ideas as to why Judah is the other picture of brotherhood, what we would expect or hope for in a brother?
Why he's
the semi-hero, what we'd hope for in a brother? Yes?
Well, this kind of goes on the confines of this class, but is this in the J tradition?
Yeah, this is a. If actually, I think this is as a story.
Theory,
I think this story is actually later than the J tradition, but I think Mike, go ahead with what you want to suggest.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, so I was fortunate enough to take a old Hebrew Bible class in undergraduate, and
if you went to a Christian college, it's okay to call it an Old Testament class.
Okay, I went to a secular university. Yeah. So, but anyway, we did learn the J and E traditions of Genesis, where you know the E represents the Elohim and generally favors Israel, the northern point of view, and the J tradition favors the southern kingdom's point of view,
and the southern kingdom is
Judah. I read the selected text was Friedman's book.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the Bible?
Yeah.
Anyway, and he pointed out that that the idea was in each different tradition to establish the hegemony of that particular area.
Yeah. I think this is a later text, at least in its final form, than either J or E. I think it has elements of J and E, but I think it's written out of the Judahite tradition. The Judahites, that's the Northern Kingdom is Israel. When the split comes, the Southern Kingdom is Judah and Benjamin. And Judah basically got to write the history. And with the great King David coming out of Judah, with the Judahites getting to write the tradition, it's really sort of embarrassing not having your forebearer stop this fratricide. So I think that's the reason we get the Judah version of the story. Because we pick right back up with Reuben having stopped things, and we come back to Reuben coming back to the pit saying, where is he? I mean, there are only 10 of them out there, right, at most. We've established that there's a communication problem in the family, but good grief. How bad is the communication problem?
Where did Reuben go? That was my question.
Well, that's...
That's
why many suggest that this Judah story is an interpolation into the story to sort of redeem Judah, the guy who needs to look good, because Judah's descendants are writing the story, or are giving us the final form of it.
Did you already talk about this, Peter? Alan Bozak has an interesting sermon about, I think, it's called like the Reuben Principle, or it's about Reuben, saying that that's how far most of us are willing to go in fighting against injustice. In other words, to lodge a protest, but make sure it's ineffective, that we're going to make sure that we saw, you know, and I think he's right on as far as like apartheid and stuff like that, that we're willing to be like Reuben and, you know, float up a little trial balloon and saying this is wrong and, you know, put our voice in. But essentially, Reuben does not go far enough to say this cannot be, it cannot happen. Yeah. But he's gotten his word in. But that's not enough. He didn't stop the injustice. And it's an incredible sermon, I think, as far as just hitting the nail on the head about, at least I really felt convicted as far as falling into that group of not doing what it takes to be effective in getting the action stopped, simply lodging a little protest.
I didn't mention that, one, because I didn't know the sermon, and two, because I take a little different reading of the story. I think there are two different pieces that get put together. And I think Reuben... Did you just come in?
Yeah.
I think Reuben is able to make, to lodge his protest, and in the original story, it's effective. But Reuben has a very different interest. He's the firstborn. His inheritance isn't as much at jeopardy. He's the firstborn of the first wife, so his inheritance should be intact. It's the other brothers, especially the brothers of the half brothers, so to speak, that are in jeopardy. So, but that's not to diminish both sides' point. I take a different read to the story. I'm calling another sower here if I'm not careful. So we get Joseph into the pit. If you everybody talks about being in the pits. I bet you most of us don't know that we're using the biblical expression. Everybody chuckles when I say that, but I'm dead serious. And Joseph in the pit, he comes in the pit again in the prison. Jeremiah in the pit when he tries to speak the truth. And it's a favorite expression of the psalmist, in the depths, in the pits, out of the pit, and so on. So I really think that's something that's migrated from our religious language into our slang, our everyday language.
This is kind of a dumb question, but did they build pits, or were they just geographical things?
They built pits. This is one of the words for a well. And they needed to. Where are we now? We're in Shechem. They didn't. They needed just to collect the water during the rainy season, so that they would have enough throughout in some areas. Some areas it was far more crucial than others, and they built a different sort of pit and covered them. That's a very good question, actually.
That's why there was, that would say something about why there wasn't water in there, which is kind of crucial.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not going to drown them any more.
So we've talked about the pits, and we've talked about what a jerky is, and the okay, fine. Because of the way I set this up and forgot about it, how I set it up when I sent the stuff to Barb, we're going to skip over the deception here today and come back to it either tomorrow or the next day, either tomorrow or Friday, about how the brothers deceive their father. Do remember, though, that one of the characteristic themes of the Jacob cycle is that all of this deception that goes on, just an unbelievable web that everybody at some point gets caught in, and the brothers will then deceive their father. Later, Joseph will deceive his brothers. Maybe we'll wind up doing those both on the same day. Joseph is sold into slavery or into servitude. We'll just end with 36. We get there's the deception going on in 30 and 20 and 30 through 35, and after the deception and we hear the description of Jacob's mourning, we end up with, meanwhile, back in Egypt, the Midianites sold him to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. We'll skip over 38. Sorry, Deanne, if you're listening. And go to 39 now. There are lots of opinions as to how well this goes together, whether or not 38 should be interspersed here. But this is another, we leave off the story in Egypt. We go back to Canaan for a little while to talk about Judah. More stories about the progenitor of the big remaining tribe, at least the remaining until 586. And we pick up with another phrase that indicates now we're going to start up the story again. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer, of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So it's the Midianites in 36 and 37, verse 36. It's Ishmaelites in 39, verse 1. At any rate, we get him down to Egypt. And this is the phrase that rings out through 39 and troubles me so much. We've just heard that he's been sold into slavery, and the next thing is, and the Lord was with Joseph. And I have real difficulty hearing that, since many of my ancestors were slaves. My grandmother was a maid, and my grandfather was a butler and a chauffeur. I have trouble connecting God being with people and being in servitude. But the thing that they're emphasizing here is how things prosper when Joseph's around. That God did preserve his life. We have to say that. And I don't know how we balance that, those of us whose ancestors made it here on those slave barges, how we balance that to say that God was with them, having let them survive that, when so many thousands of their brothers and sisters died and they had to live with them for weeks, in many cases rotting nests in them, and they didn't just cast them overboard. I don't know how we balance that. That's a real trouble spot for me. One second, okay? But the point here is that Joseph was preserved and that things prospered in his hands. Yes?
I guess this doesn't have a lot to do with this, but I'm in the middle of Chesapeake, and one of the things that the book brought out was that the Quakers were the ones who kept, looking at the slavery and saying how wrong it was, and Calvinists and Lutherans and those kinds of people weren't doing much. And I guess I just was wondering why it was the Quakers at that point had so much more insight.
Well, I don't have a real good answer for that. It seems that the Quakers or the Friends have had, in this country, have led the way with insight. They did so in slavery. They do so in peace, in the peace movement in this country. And I'm not talking about the anti-war movement. I'm talking about the peace movement. and they're connected, but they're not the same. I think some of it has to do with their understanding of power in general. Not only the lack of clergy in most cases, but the real insistence on coming to decisions by consensus within the religious community, and then the religious community is so often for them the same as their social community. And I think they have an incredible lesson to teach us. You'd be surprised to know who our only Quaker president was, though. Yeah. Richard Milhouse Nixon. although the one Quaker classmate I had in seminary said that he wasn't a real Quaker.
Couldn't this the Lord be with him being kind of a narrative putting in there? Joseph didn't realize it at the time, but the revelation later that the Lord preserved me to, you know, was what planned this out, might be kind of like the little seed putting it in there, kind of like a subliminal type thing.
I certainly think that the narrator is telling us
that's
that.
Right, yeah.
The narrator is not indicating to us that Joseph knew that, but the narrator is not indicating to us that Joseph
didn't know that.
Excuse me, because when Joseph later, when we get to the dreams, Joseph makes an incredible statement about where the power to interpret dreams comes from.
The only way with a literary background that it makes sense, I agree with your, here he is in slavery and it's doing this, but that's the way it kind of gels logically.
Yes.
In Hebrew, is this in prose?
Yes.
What's his question?
Is it in Hebrew? Is it in prose? And yes, it is. Not until you get to 45, you start to get poetry, and then all the blessings from 46 or 47 to the end of poetry.
I was saying that if it was in some form of verse, that the constant saying, the Lord was with him, could be like in Homer, a nice metrical piece.
It's a framing device, and it is in these cases that we have here in 39, it has to do with prosperity. So if anyone tells you that Scripture is not concerned with well-being, with wealth, that it's not a sign of blessing, you just tell them, look at the Joseph story. Yeah, that's a sign there, and it's one of the things that needs to be balanced with other stories about God's concern for the poor. But in this story, there can be no question that the Lord being with him has to do with his making things go well and economically in the situation. I saw a couple hands. Let's start in the back. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I wanted to say something about that, and the Lord is with Joseph. I guess I go back to free will. And there, slavery was an evil, one of the worst evils, I believe, that man has done. And today we talk about, well, if God were with us, would we have war? If God were with us, would we have this? If God were with us, would we have? So I think about the fact that God is not going to always jump in and turn around man's evil. But I think at some point, he can get into a situation and bring something good out of it. In other words, it's like this terrible thing has happened to Joseph. God saw it, but he allowed the brother's evil to work its path because this is the way God does it. It ties in with the free will. You choose to do evil, you reap what you sow. But I believe all along God did favor Joseph and kept his hands on him. And I think that's what they're referring to here, that God did keep his hands on Joseph in the face of evil.
Sure, they know the end of the story.
Huh?
They know the end of the story. And they can see the successive rises of Joseph in the midst of his successive plummeting.
Who is they?
The narrator. The narrator or narrators. John?
Yeah, there is one thing here which strikes me, that these brothers decide to sell it. And then they wait for the merchants to do it, and they even don't get the money. The merchants get the money. That's rather dumb. I mean, if you want to sell something, well, at least you get the proceeds.
There is a mention that they got 20 pieces of silver for him in the second selling story.
In the first, there's no.
No. I saw you first, and Steve.
Potiphar is an Egyptian.
Yes.
What do you make of the fact that Potiphar is the one who realizes that the Lord is with Joseph?
That's another constant theme in the Hebrew Bible.
Now, is that term is Yahweh in Hebrew?
Does it say the Lord in large letters? I'm let's see, 39. Yes,
it
Yahweh.
Says the Lord.
The master saw that, yes, that the Lord was with him. That doesn't necessarily mean that he called on the name of Yahweh.
Yeah, and
it means that he recognizes that.
But it's Joseph's God that is with him. I mean, Potiphar realized there's another God. Yeah.
It's hard to get behind this now. This is, again, the narrator is telling us this story, and that they get to put the slant on it. What Potiphar realizes is that things are going well, and when things go well, that's a sign that God is smiling. Whether Potiphar thought it was his God or his gods is something I can't answer. So, Steve?
Yeah, you may be getting at this later on, but I'm leaving today.
By the tapes. Then they'll ask me back.
You mentioned earlier the possibility of who these editors were. Are you going to talk about whether this was exilic or post-exilic and whether or not that may have an effect on how this is written?
Yeah, I think that this story is at least exilic and probably post-exilic in its final form, in the form that gets... the story is an old one, but I think the form that we get here that talks about in the midst of all this wretchedness, God has enabled life, is a theme that's post-exilic, finally. That's where I come down on this.
Is this remnant theology, then?
It could be. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, per se. I attached that whole connection to it.
Could you briefly say what the term he used?
Remnant theology?
No.
Exilic, post-exilic?
Yes.
In 586, let me just go back another jump. In 721, the Assyrians came in and took the northern kingdom away. So that all that was left...
Is that the word he's using? Assyrian?
No, exilic.
Oh, exilic.
So there's...
Exile.
So there's...
I got it now.
No, you're right. Okay. Just in case anybody else isn't...
Yeah.
The northern kingdom goes away, and that's why I say that that Judah gets to write the history, because they're the ones who have been the royal line, and then once the northern apostates are gone, they get to write them up as really bad, and as a warning to the south, of how they should worship. In 597 and 596, or 587, 586, the Babylonians come, first take away the ruling class in the south, and then take away the artisan class and leave only the very poor there. And that's the exile. Some 60 years later, depending from which one you're betting, 536, they begin to come back.
I know the exile, I just didn't know what word he was using.
Yeah, I'm just running through it since the question.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to make sure that some people don't. Certainly when we get to seminary, a lot of people don't.
I appreciate that.
And since the question came up, I seized the opportunity.
Yeah.
One more question, and I want to race through some of my crazy analogies and still have a chance to discuss them.
Okay, well, this may be backwards or irrelevant, but when it says the Lord is with Joseph, I see something, an element that Joseph didn't resist any of this. When the brothers did, and he was sold, and he couldn't have kept. To me, it's saying that Joseph may have kept the faith of the Lord. Joseph had faith that there was a reason for what was happening to him.
There is an element of that in Joseph's response when he, which we won't get to today, when he talks about when he interprets the dream for Pharaoh, that the Lord is telling you this, and there's an element that. Joseph, you know, that the brothers can interpret dreams and the Egyptians can't. I mean, there's a real awareness of Joseph that he has a faith that is different from theirs, and he's going to maintain that in spite of what has happened to him. So that there is that element there. But when we read, let's read these. What comes after the Lord was with him in just about every case. Now the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now the master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. I mean, this is very clear. There's a line of theology that says prosperity comes with God's blessing, with God's presence. That's one line of theology within the Hebrew Bible. Things went so well that he put everything into his oversight, became his personal servant, he made him overseer of his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. let me just jump into one of these analogies. People of color in the United States, both legally and officially in the Constitution, recognized in the Constitution, and later by manipulation of the wealth in the country, have been enslaved. And certainly in the part of African slavery, from the signing of the Constitution until the Civil War, which freed slaves only as a means of preserving the Union. This country prospered because of the presence of its slaves. And that begins to make me have a different way of thinking about the Lord. It begins to make it possible for me to say something about the Lord being with us in spite of what we were in, because this country prospered in that situation. And we have a tendency, at least those of us who grew up in the North, have a tendency to read this as a Southern problem. But one of the reasons that the Southerners lost the war was that they couldn't process all of those things that the slaves were, all the cotton that the slaves were picking, all the good, the agricultural goods, needed to be processed in the North. And they didn't have an outlet, didn't have an economic outlet. They couldn't get their materials in shape to sell to Europe and the rest of the North. And that was a big economic problem for the South. Now, if they couldn't get it processed in the North, doesn't that say to you that someone up here was making lots of money off slavery? So it wasn't just a Southern economic benefit. It wasn't just a Southern institution. It wasn't legal in the North. Finally, after 40, 50 years of it being ingrained in the Constitution, we began to make steps away from it. But we have a situation in my mind that's similar. That we were here, our forebears were here, and this country prospered because of it. And to deny that. That incredible contribution made even during slavery to the well-being of this country. We tend to highlight this, the contribution of free men and women, but the slaves made an incredible contribution, as do what I will call slaves, at best indentured servants, migrant workers, textile workers, Asian and Hispanic in the country today who work less than is their worth for fear of being deported, or because they're just so thankful to be away from a different sort of oppression and to have finally some opportunity. And we continue to prosper because of the way we choose to treat people of color. That's one of my wild analogies for today. I want to race to the story of Mrs. Potiphar, as I've begun calling her. To get at another wild analogy. So we left, this is 6, so we left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked at him with desire. And she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put me in charge of all that he owns." There is no one greater in this household than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" A couple of interesting things. Joseph makes an interesting separation, which apparently Potiphar only accidentally makes. This is a woman, his wife, not a piece of property. It's not a sin against Potiphar, it's a sin against God. So he seems to be in tune with some things that we don't normally associate with Israelites or Hebrews. At least the authors, when they report the story, are in tune with that. And that allows me to make this next jump, and that is that in this era of liberating women, we have failed to see that there are different levels in which people participate in the oppression. White women have participated in this. Sometimes without choice, because they're caught in the middle too. They're looking for liberation in the same way that I'm looking for liberation. But they have more power in the structure. And what has happened, and what I see happening here, is not simply the wanton woman that we often describe Mrs. Potiphar as, who just saw this good-looking young man and decided she had to have him. But was a woman whose husband thought of nothing in the household except for what was on his plate. And in her attempt to exercise some